When highly creative people are given mental health assessments, as a group, they tend to score pretty high on measures of psychological problems. They also score very high on measures of psychological health. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Research shows that one constant among creative types is that they are very interested in understanding themselves. They accept both the best and the worst of themselves and are willing to take risks to explore all facets of their personalities. Joining us to talk about the commonalities among creative people is Scott Barry Kaufman. He is scientific director of the Imagination Institute in the Positive Psychology Center at the University of Pennsylvania. His new book, written with journalist Carolyn Gregoire, is called Wired to Create, Unraveling the Mysteries of the Creative Mind. Scott, welcome back to Think.
Oh, thanks. I really enjoyed our chat last time.
What is creativity? Are innovation and artistic expression equally creative endeavors?
Are what an artistic creativity?
Innovation and artistic expression.
Ooh, what a great question. I think that there's creativity can take different forms. Overall, creativity can be defined as originality and meaningfulness. You know, does it have some sort of meaning? Whatever you bring into the world, whatever you bring into being in this world, does it have some sort of meaning or utility for people? And it can take different forms in different fields. Artistic creative expression tends to be very much about meaning and showing people a world and magnifying and enlarging experiences. Innovation is a term that's usually used in a business context, usually to refer to something that's at a very large scale, something that's produced that, maybe a technological product or something that that really covers lots of people. So that's how I would distinguish those two.
Is there such a thing as a creative personality to the extent that we either have one or we don't?
Yeah, I think all of us have the potential for creativity. I do think that there is there are some habits that creative people do over and over and over again. And in the book, Wired to Create, that just came out, we talk about these 10 habits that creative people tend to do, but that all of us can really do. At the end of the day, that's all personality really is. Personality, all of our personality characteristics and traits and behaviors are just patterns of behaviors. I don't think we should get too tripped up on the labels.
You write that creative people have messy minds. What does that mean?
They do have messy minds. And I don't mean like in the sense of like a messy desk, you know, like maybe they can have the messiest minds can have the cleanest desk. But like, you know, creative people are really good at taking lots of seemingly contradictory things and reconciling them in some way. So, you know, they may be daydreamers, but they also may have the capacity for intense mindfulness, or they may be highly sensitive, but also be really open to new experiences. They may be really good at collaboration, but also really good at solitude. These sorts of contradictions can appear messy. I wanted to make the point that creativity is characterized a lot by trial and error and variability, you know, and failing, you know, constantly, and really getting messy with the creative process and not everything being so efficient. And that is contrasted to a lot of things that we value in society that aren't creativity, like expertise and standardized test scores and things like that, where we focus on the efficiency of it and the product as opposed to the messiness of the process.
How do you test someone's creativity? Is there any purpose to that at all?
I hope there's a purpose. We've received some good funding from Templeton Foundation to give $3 million to come up with the new IQ, which is the imagination quotient, not for the purpose of limiting potential in any way, but to recognize and to track some set of skills that I would argue are really important in today's society that have been very much neglected. And they all relate to imagination and creativity in some way, but they're all different pieces of the pie. Things from inspiration to daydreaming. We have some researchers who are coming up with a daydreaming quotient to measure how much you daydream during your day as a good thing, not necessarily a bad thing. We have people, we have some people developing virtual reality environments where we can assess your rich imagination through that sort of fantasy world. And also, we have some people working on like keeping schools accountable for creativity. So it's not only always the fault of the person, right? Sometimes teachers themselves aren't particularly, gosh forbid the teacher sucks. sucks, right? You know, like we don't ever like talk about that. We're like, oh, it's all the students' fault, you know. But really, you know, kind of keeping teachers accountable for stimulating creativity in their students. That's just a sampling, but I do think it is possible to measure creativity. But we need to really think broadly about what creativity is, and it involves lots of different components.
So I've known people over the years, Scott, who walk around and will frequently say, well, I'm a right-brain thinker, I'm a left-brain thinker, and it never entirely made sense to me, and I'm glad to read that that turns out to be a myth, that dichotomy between right and left brain.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. There is this great myth that like our right brain is poetic and sensual and colorful, and our left brain is black and white and boring and realistic. And there is like that is a gross oversimplification of the functions of the two hemispheres of the brain. But when it comes to creativity in particular, we see that creativity involves a bunch of interacting brain networks and brain on both the left side and the right side of the brain. And all a brain network means is that it's just different areas of the brain are communicating with each other to handle a particular task. And depending on what stage of the creative process, maybe it's the stage where we want to get messy, or maybe it's the stage where we want to focus, or maybe it's the stage we want to collaborate with others, maybe it's the stage we want to be left alone. All that the process draws on the whole brain.
So can we deliberately activate the sort of whole brain networks that are associated with creative thinking?
We can, by engaging in these habits of creativity. It's a creative lifestyle. I really do see creativity as a lifestyle, as a way of being in the world. Creativity is a way of interacting with your world. As I say, I've said a lot before, you know, creativity really is this, lies in that beautiful interaction between your own self and your identity and your expression and the objective world that you're trying to impose meaning on.
Now, creativity doesn't necessarily equate to artistic talent. So we can be really creative and have innovative ways of looking at the world without, you know, suddenly being able to, you know, write a symphony or paint a portrait.
That's I would agree with that. Creativity, you know, you can separate talent from creativity, from intelligence. We can separate all of these constructs, as we say in science. So it is true that being a creative person in general doesn't necessarily mean you'll be creative within a specific field. And that's actually another big endeavor of the Imagination Institute over the next year and a half, as we're rounding up 50 of the most creative people on this planet from 9 different fields, and then 2 polymath events, people who are really good across fields, to really understand how creativity operates uniquely within different fields. So I think it's sensible to say that creativity is a general phenomenon as well as having specific components unique to different fields. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm curious about how our ability to play really close attention plays into creative potential.
I thought you were going to say play, the value of play.
We're going to talk about that too.
I was going to be like, yeah, I love play. I don't like paying attention, but I like play. No, you said paying attention, right?
Close attention.
Yeah. So I think like, you know, attention is a very limited resource. You know, it's just like a spotlight. We only have a spotlight of attention. And there's so much that goes underneath the level of awareness in our subconscious or our non-conscious mind that contributes to creativity. But a big part that does contribute to creativity is our ability to observe, to really, and, you know, I think there's a difference between just paying attention and truly observing. And in the book, we make that distinction a little bit. You could pay attention to something but not process it in any sort of deeper, meaningful way. But creative people seem to be really good, really astute observers of human nature, especially writers and poets. They're very astute observers of human nature, and they really are able to see the larger patterns.
So let's talk about playfulness and play. Often today we associate play with something that someone has already invented for us, and we sit down and we play a game or we play with a toy. That's not exactly what you're talking about here necessarily.
That's right. I'm not talking about like rough and tumble play, but a form of play called of imaginative play. Our ability to play with ideas, to take alternative stances on something. You know, if we strongly believe in something, you know, playfully thinking through what would someone else's perspective think of, how could it be wrong, thinking about the future. This we call this in the field imaginative play, or some researchers call it pretend play. It is a very valuable skill for creative accomplishment.
This is something that can be hard for adults to sort of lock back into. Something that we did so easily as children doesn't come quite as naturally when we're adults.
I know. I think it's very worth for adults to take stock of their life and think, how much of my life is work? Like, is my life just comprising work, you know? And if it's not comprising play at all, I think that there should be a serious play intervention. It could take various forms. Maybe joining an improv theater company and just taking lessons. Or I have a friend in New York City who started a preschool for adults.
Preschool?
Which is total.
How does that work?
Yeah. It's awesome. They people can enroll and they you know, they do all the things we did in preschool to get back in touch with your inner child, like, you know, getting messy on you know, with paint and stuff and glue, just thinking outside the box in a playful way. I mean, there's so many opportunities though in our daily life to be playful, and I think people just, like, when we get to become adults, we forget that.
I want to talk about this idea of thinking outside the box and, you know, coming up with, you know, associations we might not have made before. Sometimes it feels like we are under pressure to be creative, and I have to wonder if that's not counterproductive.
Yeah, it is. It is a good question. We it is very counterproductive. We get constant pressures from all over to do things that other people want us to do. And that does take us away from ourselves, and it takes us away from our unique source of creativity, which is ourself and our identity and our own meaning-making system. So it is very detrimental. I mean, it's a long literature on the difference between intrinsic rewards and extrinsic rewards. And we know that intrinsically motivated people that are motivated not for any sort of external reward, do tend to be much more creative.
All right, so let's talk about this being in touch with ourselves. Very creative people tend to be really invested in understanding themselves.
Yeah, I think that creative people are more comfortable getting intimate with themselves, and both the light and the dark side, and kind of reconciling and integrating these two things. I mean, gosh, psychologists for a very long time have been talking about the importance of integration of these two selves. You know, Carl Jung talked about, you know, the shadow self, right? And the importance of differentiation, which was the form of integration. Carl Rogers talked about it. I mean, people have talked about this for a long time, and we know that it really is, creative people are really good at that sort of integration process.
So it doesn't necessarily mean thinking that you're the center of the universe. It just means trying to sort of realize what makes us tick.
Yeah, I don't think there's a strong correlation between narcissism and creativity. Yeah, but there's a correlation between narcissism and self-reported creativity.
We're speaking this hour with Scott Barry Kaufman. He is scientific director of the Imagination Institute in the Positive Psychology Center at the University of Pennsylvania. His new book is called Wired to Create, Unraveling the Mysteries of the Creative Mind. If you've got a question or you want to share with us something you do to tap into your creative potential, we'd love to hear from you at 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Scott Barry Kaufman of the Positive Psychology Center at the University of Pennsylvania about his new book, Wired to Create, Unraveling the Mysteries of the Creative Mind. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Scott, there have long been anecdotal associations made between creative abilities and susceptibility to mental illness. What happens when those associations are sort of studied in depth by experts?
Yeah, so I want to say first off the bat that mental illness is not necessary or sufficient for creativity. But all of us, you know, the Buddha said that we have a life of 10,000 joys, 10,000 sorrows. I mean, all of us have suffering in our lives and as well as joy. And creative people, what they're really good at is channeling that into some sort of creative endeavor or some sort of creative form of creative expression. Now, with that said, there are some interesting connections between the kind of mind that may be prone to schizophrenia or prone to psychosis and the kind of mind that can imagine really amazing new worlds and things and inventions that no one has ever thought of before, really creative minds. And you do find that at a neurological level, there are similarities between people diagnosed with schizophrenia and creative people. The difference is that creative people are able to go to that world. They're able, as my improv teacher used to say, Crazy Town. they're able to go to Crazy Town, and in a positive, it's like not always a bad thing to go to Crazy. I mean, some of the most craziest ideas are, you know, turn out to be the greatest ideas of all time. So they're able to go to Crazy Town, but also think through and have this sort of higher order rational facilities to separate it, the truly impractical from the ideas that need fleshing out.
Is there a right way to daydream? Is it something we should practice, or does it have to happen organically?
Oh, I think that there's it's very contextual. I mean, there's a time and place for daydreaming, right? You know, when you're taking the SATs, you don't want to be daydreaming about the cute girl sitting next to you in the cubicle. I don't know where I thought of that example, but you know, or when you're driving, you don't want to be daydreaming about, you know, anything. But I think that there's a great time, you know, for daydreaming, and that's what I talk about in the book. And there's my mentor Jerome Singer called it positive constructive daydreaming, and it's a form of daydreaming where you non-judgmentally think about your wishes and your desires and your future self and all your unresolved issues in a constructive way to try to solve problems. And that can be distinguished from different other styles of daydreaming that are not as adaptive. So there's guilty dysphoric daydreaming where you're constantly ruminating and worrying about everything. And that's why a lot of people do mindfulness to get rid of that form of daydreaming. But let's not throw out the baby with the bathwater, right? You know, there are definitely forms of daydreaming that are very valuable.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. On the phone now, we have Max in Dallas. Hi, Max. Max, are you with us? Okay, I think Max had a question about...
I can impersonate Max.
Okay, pretend that
Hello,
you're...
Hello, I am Max. Okay, I'll
pretend that you're asking a question about how something like yoga might affect creativity.
Yeah, yoga is... I know yoga is really, like, hot right now, right? Yoga, mindfulness, all this stuff. I think that in a sense, it can be very helpful to quiet the mind and focus, so that when you go back to your creative endeavor, you can be more likely to get into the flow state. This flow state of consciousness, we know, is really important for creativity. It's really important for focusing and being completely absorbed in an activity that you're engaged in, and you kind of lose track of time and all that. So these yoga practices and things like that can certainly be helpful to quieting that inner chatter. So good question, Max.
One of the most creative people I know works the strangest hours that I've heard of. She doesn't have to punch a clock, and so she might come in the office at 4 p.m. and leave at 2 a.m. This would not work for me, but it seems to suit the rhythms of her brain.
So you're saying some people prefer the routine? Is that what you're
well,
saying?
Well, no, I'm saying, you know, she knows when she's feeling creative and she gets to work as opposed to, you know, making sure that she hits, you know, the office at a certain time or sits down to work at a certain time.
That, yeah, I like that. There is some recent research showing that people who set their own schedules, that is correlated with creativity. And it's a sort of the idea there is that you have some sort of autonomy in your life, or you're able to be the author of your own life, and it's also related to what we already talked to you about it, the importance of intrinsic motivation. All that stuff is going to be related to creativity. But I mean, if that's not the kind of person, like if you get sometimes some people can get great creativity out of structure, and sometimes constraints can be very conducive to creativity. So maybe there are personality differences there that moderate it.
Does too much external stimulation get in the way of creativity? If we always have something to keep us from getting bored, is that an impediment?
You're asking really good questions.
Thanks.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about stimulation is it's a very complicated – I wish there were easy answers, but we know that highly creative people tend to be more sensitive, and they also tend to be more sensitive to stimulation, like noises and loud, bright lights, and all this stuff can get in the way of creativity because it's distracting you from yourself, is a way of putting it. It's really making it harder for you to access those subconscious associations that your subconscious mind has been at hard work to come up with a creative insight. And it can also, and for a lot of creative people, it can also be very overwhelming and frazzling. I don't know, is that a word, frazzling?
Frazzling.
They can get frazzled. They can get frazzled. I think I just made up the word. It can be very frazzling. So you see, you know, this high sensitivity level of creative people. And the sensitivity is a very interesting dimension of creative people because when they're engaged in their actual activity, it's kind of like they become a different person. So some of the greatest heavy metal musicians that have been interviewed in a terrific study done by my colleague Jennifer Grimes, interviewed these heavy metal musicians backstage, found they were also the most sensitive to noise.
Wow. That would be maddening, certainly, if you were really sensitive to noise in that situation.
Yeah, but when they're on the stage and they're the ones that are controlling the noise, you see, it's a different story. They can get into the flow state and really produce something terrific.
We have an email here from Andrew who wants to know if there is objective evidence to support a correlation between drug use and creativity.
You know, I get asked this question a lot. I wonder why. am I considered an expert on drugs? But you know, the thing is, there is some research going back to the 50s and 60s, and I think it is unfortunate that the federal government has shut down a lot of this research because there were some promising results showing that LSD was related to at least people reporting that they felt more creative. However, you know, it's like one of those kind of things where a lot of them, when they got out of the state, they said, oh, that was not creative at all. You know, there's something about the state of consciousness you're in on LSD that makes you feel more open to new experiences, which is a strong predictor of probably the most strongest predictor of creativity. And then we can look at other drugs and like alcohol, for instance, and in moderation. I want to be very clear here. You know, having like one glass of wine, and if you're above the age of 18, having one glass of wine above your, you know, next to you while you're writing or something, it does lower that prefrontal cortex guard a little bit and lets those associations flow a little bit more freely.
So one theme in this book is the value of risk-taking or willingness to take risks. What does it mean exactly to take risks in pursuit of creativity? You're not talking about, you know, wandering around on the roof of your house. So what kinds of risks are we looking at here?
No, not dangerous risks to your physical nature, but there are so many risks that aren't truly dangerous to ourselves or others that still petrify us. You know, we're afraid to approach new people. You know, we're, you know, a lot of people have social anxiety. A lot of people are scared to leave their house. A lot of people are scared to quit their job and embrace the unknown. And I want to make it very clear to people that part of the creative lifestyle is embracing the unknown and embracing complexity. Out of all of the characteristics of creative people, something that really stood out in a famous study by the great scientist Frank X. Barron of creative people in the 60s and 70s was that the greatest creative people of that generation, he had Truman Capote there and lots of other really great writers and artists, and they found that it was their ability to embrace to not only embrace, but they loved complexity, and they loved, like, you know, the Rorschach test, you know, of like, what does this look like? They preferred the ones that were incomplete. And so they're, you know, whereas the non-creative people hated it. They hated the
Where's
ones
the
that
rest
were
incomplete. Of the picture? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let me ask you this, Scott. You know, there are people who will say, I'm just not creative. And maybe they are okay with that, and maybe they're not. Is it okay to not want to be more creative? I mean, is there something wrong with people who feel like that's for other people and they're
Absolutely.
Happy the way they are?
Absolutely. It's like any trait or characteristic. You know, I may sound here like I'm saying creativity is the best thing since sliced bread, but not everybody likes sliced bread. You know, like, I mean, it's fine. You know, there are so many different traits and characteristics on offer in this world. There, some people well being. Although I would argue creativity can be a great source of well being, but there can be lots of other things that can lead to fulfillment in life than well being. You know, intelligence is another thing. Like, does everyone need like really extraordinarily high like IQ type intelligence to live a satisfying creative life? No. Does everyone? You know, so it's I would say that that's fine. You know, there's some people. What I don't think is fine is someone who says I'm just not like someone that really deep down in their gut, like, they know they want to be more creative, they want to self-express themselves more, but because they're scared, they create defenses and say, I'm just not a creative person. You need to really look beneath the surface, and you do see those kinds of people. There are people that truly deep down want to desperately be a creative person, but they don't think that they can be. And for those people, I do want to make it clear that they can be, that these are the habits of creative people that we're talking about. Now, of course, there are some people that are like, no, deep down, they really could care less about creativity, and that's totally fine. You know, I'm not shaming anyone.
What do really creative people understand about responding to their own failures that maybe the rest of us haven't learned yet?
Oh, wow. What a great. You're on fire today, Chris Boyd.
Thanks.
Yeah. There's a whole new field called post-traumatic growth. I don't know if you've heard of that field of positive psychology. And creative people tend to be really good at taking these inevitable struggles that they that all of us go through in life and channeling it in some sort of creative way, putting it into their art, and magnifying those experiences for others. You know, some of the greatest works, you know, look at Shakespeare's tragedies, you look at some of the, we're born out of suffering, or born out of, you know, an astute awareness of human suffering, and, you know, of course, trauma is not something to be romanticized, or to be, you know, we should fully understand how horrible it can be to go through trauma, but what this emerging field of post-traumatic growth is showing is that lots and lots of people who've had horrible traumas are turning it into good fodder for their creativity.
An email from Tim wants to know if there is a correlation between being left-handed and being creative.
That's another great question. Like, I get the drugs question and the left-handed question a lot. It's interesting. Yeah, I wonder if people with left hands do more drugs. I don't know. Anyway, it's irrelevant. I don't know the data on it. This is why I'm tap dancing around that question, because I don't think anyone's done a really truly good study on that link. I've seen the link between left-handed and spatial abilities, because it projects to your right hemisphere, which is but I've already broken down the left brain, right brain myth of creativity. So I wouldn't extrapolate from the visual spatial finding necessarily to creativity, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we have another email here. This one from MC, who wants to know if there are clear differences between being creative in collaborative settings versus independently, and what effect externally or internally imposed competition might have on creativity.
That's good. Yeah, they're kind of two questions. I mean, the collaboration process can be very important for getting your ideas out of your head, get them tested on other people, hearing other people's ideas, integrating them. And done right, that can be good. Brainstorming has not been shown to be very conducive to creativity. Well, you tend to get in brainstorming sessions, you tend to get the extroverts, or just, you know, talk.
Dominate.
They love dominating. That's the thing about extroverts. They love dominating. So they love it. And the introverts hate being dominated. You know, like, so it's a very frustrating experience. But there can be useful sources of collaboration for sure, and especially when there are external pressures to. So there are exceptions to the intrinsic-extrinsic motivation thing, and sometimes pressure, like a big push to do something, create a product within like 12 hours, you know, like Steve Jobs is saying, you have to create this. They're like, it's going to take us four years to create. And he says, it'll take you 4 days. You know, like, that puts you into a hyper state of consciousness where your inner critic is gone. So when your inner critic is, because you don't have time for that inner critic to be there, right? You 4 days. And that hyper level of awareness can actually turbocharge your creativity. So there are some exceptions to this. I think that's an excellent question that person asked.
That's really interesting because it sort of explains how sometimes in a crisis, people are able to come up with a solution that you just can't even believe they were able to come up with. And maybe it's because that inner critic, you know, that inner critic, she's shoved out of the way because you have to deal with a better hand.
We have reserves that are amazing. I just thought of an example that I feel like now sounds like I'm going to brag about this. But there were these two German young ladies on the train the other day, and they had trouble with the bag, you know, the luggage, and it must have weighed like so. And there's no way in my ordinary life I could have picked up that bag. But like, I wanted to impress them so badly. They were really cute, and I was like, okay, I'm going to do this. I was like, don't worry, I'll get this. And I started to lift it. I realized there's no way that I could lift it. Yet I somehow wanted to so badly that I did it. I lifted the whole thing and put it on the top of the thing. And I was reflecting on that later, and I was reflecting, oh my gosh, there's so much reserves in me and probably in everyone that I had no idea. And so I use that as a metaphor. Thanks for letting me go through that awkward story. But I think there's a good metaphor there for creativity as well. And you know, we have these huge reservoirs of untapped creative potential we don't even realize until we are put into that state of consciousness.
Scott Barry Kaufman is with us. His new book is Wired to Create, Unraveling the Mysteries of the Creative Mind. We'll be back in 2 minutes. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Scott Barry Kaufman, who is Scientific Director of the Imagination Institute in the Positive Psychology Center at the University of Pennsylvania. His new book is called Wired to Create, Unraveling the Mysteries of the Creative Mind. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. You say that openness to experience is the single strongest and most consistent personality trait that predicts creative achievement. What do you mean by openness to experience?
Wonderful rephrasing of that. I mean, you hit all the important points there. Out of all the personality traits, it is the most consistently across the board different kinds of creative forms like arts and sciences. Openness to experience is a cognitive exploration of your inner and outer worlds. So you're aware of your experiences, your inner experiences, you're aware of your and open to all sorts of experiences outside of yourself. Now, that can be broken down into intellectual curiosity, so you can be really interested in ideas and understanding things. It can be appreciation of beauty. It can be openness to your emotions. And in my own research, I've broken it down just in that way. An openness to intellectual ideas, an openness to fantasy and emotions and aesthetics. It can be broken down into these different things, and they're related. And these different forms of openness to experience are related to different forms of creativity. So scientists tend to be very high in intellectual curiosity. Whereas artists also can be high in intellectual curiosity, but they tend to have greater appreciation of beauty.
So you talked earlier about habits and sort of coming up with, you know, habits that will allow us to tap into our creative potential. I wonder, though, if we have to change those habits up. You know, if you get up every day and you want to spend, 10 minutes sort of thinking about yourself and your place in the world, at some point, maybe that is less useful than it once was.
Yeah, I like that. Habits can be changed, I'm trying to stop picking my nails. It's one of my New Year's resolutions. We can absolutely change our habits. There are many ways to do that. We could do a whole other show on like habit change, right? But just believe me that there's methods and things you can do. And with the creativity things we offer in the book, I think that it's a matter of making the choice that you're going to be a creative being. That's part of who you are. I am a creative person. And once you kind of integrate that into your identity, all these things come along the ride for it, all these habits we talk about in the book, which you can practice every day. Force yourself, to wake up, force yourself to question assumptions, to be more playful in responses to people. I've awkwardly tried to be playful with you today.
It's worked out fine.
Yay! Be more playful, to be more open to challenges and to complexity and to the unknown. If there's something that's a great unknown, going towards it and trying to comprehend it, understand it, make sense of it, as opposed to avoiding it and going to something that's your normal every day. And then there are lots of other things as well we talk about in the book.
It's one thing to try to understand and experience the world in a way that is different than what everyone else is doing or what you yourself have done in the past. It's another thing to, have to sort of publicly reject conformity. Can you talk about some ways that we can all find the courage to do that? If it doesn't hurt anybody else, what does it take to go against the grain and just sort of own that?
You need to have a belief in your own self and your own idea. Creative people, E. Paul Torrens found that creative people were very comfortable being a minority of one. They're very comfortable having, actually found that these kids in elementary school, sometimes it shows itself really early, and a lot of these kids are in detention, and get all label, all sorts of labels, ADHD to everything, behavioral problems. But they are comfortable being the only one in the class having an idea, believing in something, having some value that no one else agrees with in that classroom. And I think that we shouldn't lose that as adults. I do think as kids we are more playful, and we also are more comfortable being a minority of one, but we get all these, the more we get enculturated, the more we lose that. And I think it's something that any of us can get back. We have to be very we can work on our self confidence in a lot of ways. And another way of getting there is also working on our self-compassion. And there's a lot of great, terrific research by Krista Neff and others in the field of positive psychology that I work in on being more compassionate to yourself. And if you have an idea, saying, like, what would I say to a friend who really believed in something that was important to them? I would tell that friend to go for it and to not worry about the haters. Take valuable criticism, but don't, listen to the haters. And you need to have that same attitude with yourself.
I was thinking about ways we might cultivate creativity in the education system. And here we have a message from Sterling, a listener who asks, if you know anything about creativity from being homeschooled as compared with going to school in a regular classroom.
Yeah, that's a great question. I want to be careful in my response. I don't know about the systematic research on that topic. I just know personally that a lot of parents are fed up with the school system. They're fed up with their son or daughter may be 4 or 5 grades ahead, or might not have, or may have a learning disability, or be having a learning disability and be 4 or 5 grades ahead. They're not always mutually incompatible, but that their needs are not being met in the regular school system. And a lot of parents I know that that do homeschool the children find that it's much better for their child to express themselves and to get the needs that, that they need. So I don't blame parents who want to homeschool their children in the kind of society and educational structure we have that's so biased against creativity. Another way of saying biased against creativity is also biased against uniqueness. You know, the parents are, it's no surprise that parents are turning to alternative methods of education.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Jim on the line in Dallas. Hi, Jim.
Oh, thanks. My question is, how do you differentiate, or do you, between a the person who is creative and a person who is a scientist? They seem to be pursuing the same mindset and the same ends. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call.
Well, okay, so in any – great question. In any field, you can be a creative person in that field or a not creative person in that field. You know, you can be – now, there are certain fields where you don't want to be more creative. Like, you don't want to be a creative accountant. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But or a creative pilot. You know, but with that said, there are more creative scientists and less creative scientists. So he seemed to have that assumption that that science wasn't a creative field and that you can't be creative within science. But, you know, my colleague Gregory Feiss has done great studies showing that even within creativity – actually, I've done this research too. You could differentiate more creative scientists, those who are really pushing the field forward, who are coming up and imagining new hypotheses that no one else has thought of, new ways of testing things in the world, and imagining new devices or things that can transform and help society. You know, that's the benefit of imagination and creativity, and you can do that in any field. Like I said, you might not want to do that in every field, but science is certainly a field where you can and should do that.
You have an interesting chapter in the book about intuition and insight, and it seems like there's a difference between people who know all the same facts, but some people are able to connect two facts that don't seem related at all and make something new out of them, and some people don't ever make that leap.
Yeah, creativity is all about connecting dots. There are certain kinds of minds that have what's referred to as a reduced latent inhibition. I'm dropping some science on you there.
we can take it.
Yeah, I know you can. Basically talking about their ability to have a lower threshold of information entering their consciousness. So they don't screen everything automatically that seems irrelevant to the task at hand. And people who have this reduced – we just call it reduced filter, and that probably makes more intuitive sense to people – it's been correlated with higher levels of creative achievement when it's coupled with high intelligence or high working memory, your ability to somehow take all that incoming information and in consciousness and sort it out.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Lindsay on the line in Dallas. Hello, Lindsay.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Hi, Lindsay.
Hi. You mentioned a flow stage, and I was curious as to what that meant.
A little more about flow.
I saw that in a sports journal one time, but that's about all I saw or heard.
That's a good question, because flow is so essential to the creative process, and I kind of take it for granted that it's like everyone knows what flow is, but not everyone does, and they should. You know, the flow state is the state of consciousness where you're completely absorbed in an activity. All time seems to recede in the background. You look up at the clock and you're like, what the beep just happened? You know, like, how did I, like, an hour just passed? Like this interview right now, I can't believe it's almost over. You know, like, we've been in the flow state here. And that state of consciousness is really essential to creativity. You're loosening your associations. You're fully absorbed and engaged in your activity. And that inner critic is not judging every step of what you're doing. And there are some stages of the creative process where you want that inner critic, but for the most creative parts of the creative process, you don't really want that.
Is caffeine good for creativity?
Oh, you were asking such good questions today. We've covered everything, haven't we? LSD, alcohol, caffeine. People want all sorts of, you know, artificial stimulants for creativity. Well, you know, I don't know about that. I did know the data about the LSD. I did know the data about the alcohol. The thing with caffeine, which is interesting and maybe a way into answering that question, is we do know that caffeine improves your dopamine levels. And I write a lot in this book about the crucial aspect, the crucial link between dopamine and openness to new experiences, as well as extroversion. I wonder if it's such a good question, and I would love to nerd out with you about this someday, because there are different dopamine projections, and I'm already like forming a hypothesis in my head about basically what I just formulated in my head. In long story short, is I don't think the kind of dopamine that's stimulated by caffeine is relevant more to the reward pathway of extroversion, but I don't think it's going to be as relevant to the information seeking pathway of openness to experience that I talk about in this book.
All right. Well, we'll check in with you sometime in the future in case
I'll
have
do the study.
We have a great question here via email. It says, I have two musician friends who've told me that when they are creative, it feels like the creativity doesn't belong to them and is being channeled from an external place. This goes along with the ancient Greek idea of the muse. What are your thoughts on this?
It's true. Our brain, even at the brain level, we see that is happening. You know, there were jazz improvisers that were put in the fMRI scanner, as well as rappers, and they were asked to improvise. And what they found in the brain area is that their brain, certain areas of the brain were processing information before the person subjectively reported thinking about it. And that's really, really, truly interesting from a consciousness perspective. It does seem like the flow state of consciousness is an altered state of consciousness where we are not fully metacognitively aware of what we're doing, which can give us the feeling as though it's an out-of-body experience. Now, is it magical? Well, I don't think so. I think that that's just suggesting that it's a special state of consciousness we can get in where our subconscious is allowed to roam free, and then we kind of just like witness it afterwards.
Since you work in the Positive Psychology Center at the University of Pennsylvania, woo-hoo! Is there any evidence that creative people are happier than everybody else?
Interesting question. Very loaded question. The happiness as happiness and well-being, what we're learning in the field of positive psychology, is that it's a multidimensional term. So there's lots of different elements of well-being. It's not just feeling good or feeling positive. It's also having meaning in your life. It's also having good social relationships or having a purpose, having achievement, feeling engaged in what you're doing. And creativity, the latest research suggests that while creativity is not necessarily related to the sort of happy, joy kind of happiness, which is a more superficial form of happiness, because a lot of people who are suffering are being creative, right? So on average, what creativity does seem to be associated with is the forms of well-being that has to do with engagement, like we already talked about flow, and that's a form of well-being, engagement, achievement, and meaning.
Scott Barry Kaufman is Scientific Director of the Imagination Institute at the Positive Psychology Center at the University of Pennsylvania. His new book, written with journalist Carolyn Gregoire, is called Wired to Create, Unraveling the Mysteries of the Creative Mind. Scott, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh my gosh, I love talking to you. Have a great day.
You too. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer, and our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.